Welcome to World War I Centennial News. It's about World War I news 100 years ago this week, and it's about World War I now, news and updates about the centennial and the commemoration. World War I Centennial News is brought to you by the U.S. World War I Centennial Commission and the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Today is March 8th, 2017, and your host is Teresa Sims.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the U.S. World War I Centennial Commission Studios. I am Teresa Sims, and I'm your host. Today, we're going to start our first story by looking at what was happening in World War I 100 years ago this week. Due to the deteriorating diplomatic relations, Germany had lost the right to conduct business at America's shipping ports. In response, they called upon a treaty in 1799 that allowed the German government to claim that she could send prize ships to the United States, keeping them there indefinitely, and to even sell off their cargoes there. Well, if this was the case, Germany, auxiliary cruisers, and long-range submarines could essentially use the United States as a base, sending captured prizes back to the United States for safekeeping and profit. But this was not the case. On March 6, 1917, the Supreme Court unanimously ruled against the Germans and put an end to this practice. There's more about this story. You can follow the link in the chat room and learn more about the Supreme Court's ruling to keep Germany from keeping prize ships in the U.S. But really, the big story of the week is about the Zimmermann telegram, which is a subject of Mike Schuster's Great War Project blog. Mike, what's the headline for this week?
Thanks, Teresa. Well, some of the headlines this week a century ago would be, will the U.S. enter the war? Debate sharpens amidst submarine attacks, secret plotting. Britain regaining offensive, Russia collapsing. And this is special to the Great War Project. Across the globe a century ago, events are speeding up with the United States hurtling toward war. The Zimmermann telegram was published in the United States on March 1st, reports historian Martin Gilbert. The telegram from the German foreign minister to his counterpart in Mexico City urges Mexico to join Germany in the fight against the U.S. Many in the United States who sought to keep the nation out of war denounced the telegram as a fake, a forgery. For its trouble, according to the telegram, at the end of the war, Mexico would regain Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico, all territories it had lost in wars with the U.S. in the 19th century. 2 days later, reports Gilbert, the German foreign minister confirms that the telegram is real. One more nail, Gilbert observes, had been knocked into the coffin of American neutrality. Far afield from Western Europe, reports Gilbert, the Allied war in the Middle East and Turkey is once again gaining momentum. The British Army is on the march in Mesopotamia, now Iraq. They are targeting the city of Kut on the Tigris River south of Baghdad, which they had lost the year before. The British moving upriver reach Kut a century ago and take more than 1,700 Turkish prisoners. The British are now within 25 miles of Baghdad. Elsewhere in the Middle East, reports historian Gilbert, the Turks lose ground in Persia, now Iran, and Arabia. The British also make progress in Palestine and the Sinai. All these gains appear to put to rest Germany's ambition to become the dominant European nation in the Middle East after the war. The Turks see the writing on the wall and begin their withdrawal from Baghdad. Crucial developments in Russia are also unfolding rapidly. On March 3rd, 100 years ago, a strike breaks out in Petrograd, now St. Petersburg. The strike is targeting a key munitions work, reports Gilbert, the Army's main provider of weapons and ammunition. On the same day, a bread shop in Petrograd is looted, sparking riots. Turmoil in Russia is spreading rapidly. In just a few days, an estimated 90,000 Russians are on strike. At the same time, the Russian government is about to declare martial law in Petrograd. The situation in Russia is serious now, with no clear idea of where it is headed. At the same time, reports historian Gilbert, U.S. President Woodrow Wilson tells the United States Congress, "We stand fast on armed neutrality." Within days, though, German submarines attack and sink several American merchant ships. Although America is now clearly in the gun sights of Germany's U-boats, Wilson resolutely resists increasing calls in America for the U.S. to join the war. In Germany, many dismiss the fear that the action on the seas will draw the U.S. into the war. Those who express such views are dismissed for indulging in so-called humanitarian babbling. much skepticism also in Germany that America can change things. If the USA did intervene, writes historian Norman Stone, would it really make any significant difference? German leaders say no. And that's some of the news from this week, century ago, from the Great War Project.
Thanks, Mike. And that's Mike Schuster with the Great War Project blog. So now we've heard from the land and the sea, what was going on in the sky? Let's find out what's happening this week in the skies over Europe in today's War in the Sky segment. Teo, take it away.
100 years ago this week, on March 8, 1917, Count Ferdinand von Zeppelin died. Let me tell you a little bit about this very interesting man who developed the giant flying machine, which is what his invention was originally called in German, Riesenflugzeug, or in 21st century American, ginormous airplane. We'll start in 1863 when the Baron took leave from the Württembergian army, later part of Germany, to be an observer in the Union Army of the Potomac. Yep, he came to America during the Civil War and hooked up with the Virginians. During the Battle of Fredericksburg, which the Union lost, he's said to have launched a balloon with a soldier in it, ostensibly as a lookout, and maybe as a good target practice for the Confederates, too. A little bit after that battle, he took off on a road trip with a couple of Russians, soldiers, and some Native American Indian guides up the western end of Lake Superior, over the St. Louis River, and across to Crow Wing, Minnesota on the upper Mississippi, then down to St. Paul. Turns out that there was a German-born balloonist there named Johann Steiner, who was selling balloon rides. Well, it was up, up, and away for the good Baron in Johann's beautiful balloon, which apparently had quite an impact on him. And about 10 years later, in 1874, after doing a bunch more war fighting, the idea of a big airship shows up in the Baron's diary. It was a pretty innovative approach that he outlined. He imagined that rather than a balloon, all soft fabric, he would build a large rigid frame of light metal, and inside of that he'd put a bunch of separate gas bags. That would lift the whole beast, and it could be, well, ginormous. There were other good ideas floating around at the time, and a French duo called Renard and Krebs made something somewhat similar, so he beat feet back to go talk to the King of Württemberg to finance the development of his vision. It went well, and it went not so well, but fast forward to 1895, when he got a patent on his design. So a year later, in 1896, he finds an initial investor to back him. And finally, on the 2nd of July in 1900, the Zeppelin airship LZ-1 made its first flight over Lake Constance in South Germany for 20 minutes, and then it got messed up on the landing. But his idea was proven, and he pulls off a kind of a turn-of-the-century Kickstarter to build the LZ-2, then dumps his rich wife's fortune into the venture. Long story short, he hooks up with a customer-slash-partner called Delag, and together they create a thriving enterprise by going into the Zeppelin passenger-carrying business. By 1914, they'd carried over 37,000 passengers on 1,600 flights without a hitch, ushering in a new era of air transportation. Then came the war. Count von Zeppelin died this week in 1917, before the Treaty of Versailles shut down Zeppelin technology, or before the second round of ZepDev that created the world-circling LZ-127 and the famous Hindenburg, and way before his tribute rock band Led Zeppelin wrote Stairway to Heaven, whose lyrics were clearly not about the Baron von Zeppelin, who died 100 years ago this week. Or were they?
Thanks, Teo. And if you want to know more about the Zeppelin, please go to the timeline in the Wars in the Sky by going to www.cc.org/war-in-the-sky. Take a look and share some interesting stories about those who served 100 years ago by viewing the three new episodes on the Great War Channel. The first one is Russia before the 1917 revolution. The second is Liechtenstein, San Marino, Monaco, and Andorra in World War I. And the third, Conrad loses his job, Neville's coup. You can find them at youtube.com/user/the Great War. Now let's look forward to what is happening to commemorate the Great War. It's time for World War I now. We'll start off with some news from the Commission. As we've been talking about several weeks now, we have the World War I Poppy Program. Well, we'd like to welcome a new partner with the American Association for State and Local History in the new World War I Poppy Program. This is a state and local history association. It's a national organization, and they provide leadership and support for its members. And their role is to help preserve and interpret state and local history in order to make the past more meaningful for all people, to bring history to life, in other words. They have over 6,000 members, and we really want to salute you. Thanks for helping us to plant the seeds of remembrance. If you'd like to know more about their association, or if you'd like to know about the Poppy Program, you can find information about the Poppy Program at ww1cc.org/poppy. And then there's a link in the chat room about the association. In our activities and events this week, we highlight a couple things. So I went through the calendar, and I've chosen two events that I think are very interesting and quite cool. So the first one is Citizen Artists World War I and the Creative Economy Symposium. And this is going to be this Saturday, March 11th, from 9 to 5 at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts in Philadelphia. It's a two-day symposium. It examines the creative contributions of American artists and citizens before, during, and after World War I. It considers that delicate relationship between military conflict and visual culture and the deployment of everyday citizens in the pursuit of national agendas through art and art making. And it addresses racial and gender roles and the interminglings of memory and mythology and our understanding of our own history. Highly encourage you to go to the PAF if you can. The second one I've selected is Researching Your U.S. World War I Army Ancestors. And with less than 30 days to the U.S. entry into war, that 100-year anniversary on April 6, this is a good time to really look into your own family's background and to find your connections to World War I. And this is a wonderful resource, and you have a link in the chat room to do your own research about your ancestors from your family lines. It's time for some updates from the states. This week, the Illinois State Commission has published a complete list of World War I happening in the states. Whether you live in the area or you're planning a trip there, take a peek at the list and see if there's something you might like to attend. They've got a really, really diverse program. Encourage you to look at the list in the chat room. Other news around the states. We're happy to announce officially the establishment of the New England region. This is hot off the press. This happened yesterday. The inaugural meeting took place yesterday, as I was saying, with representatives from Connecticut, Massachusetts, Maine, Rhode Island, Vermont, and the commission joining the meeting. It overall was fantastic. New England is already carrying out a great deal of centennial commemoration, and we are very confident that the formation of this new region will only magnify their commemoration activities. Stephen Tabor of Massachusetts will take on the role of the regional coordinator for New England. Thanks, Steve. That's a wonderful, wonderful gift that you're giving to the commission and to the nation. We wish him and all the region's members the best of luck moving forward in this centennial. We're also equally happy to announce that tomorrow we will kick off the Mid-Atlantic region at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. And this region will consist of Washington, D.C., Delaware, Maryland, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and West Virginia. Now we'll take a broader look at the war with the International Report. It's Women's History Month here in the United States, so we're going to start off our International Report with an interesting story about women from the UK. The headline reads, From Maids to Mechanics, Incredible Pictures of the Women Who Swat a Humdrum Life in Wartime Britain for Service with the Army in World War I. 3 years into war, Britain was running short of men. To carry on the fight, the government called on the services of thousands of women who swapped the dreariness of wartime Britain for the peril of life on the front line. The Women's Army Auxiliary Corps was formed 100 years ago this month. This article features many interesting images of life in the Corps. Take a look at it when you have a chance. Also from the UK, the headline reads, Life in the Trenches, Incredible, Never-Seen Photos of World War I Through the Eyes of a German Soldier on the Front Line Emerge. A PhD student unearthed an extraordinary trove of photos while researching his thesis. Taken by medical officer Robert Licht, the snapshots document daily life in the trenches and beyond. The most shocking photo is from the collection was taken during an operation, which was really a rarity since photographers weren't permitted in the medical areas. You can see these photos and read the full story by following the link. Next, we have some new posts and articles to bring to your attention. Stop by our site to see an interview with Doug Batson, who is a living history performer for Dr. Isaiah Bowman. Bowman, then director of the American Geographical Society, was tapped by President Wilson to lead the inquiry. It's a group of distinguished geographers who served as a precursor to today's National Intelligence Council. Batson himself is a former military geographer and an expert in the geography of World War I. This is really interesting. I encourage you to take a look at it when you get a minute. The 100-year anniversary of America's entrance into the Great War is less than 30 days away. The National Museum of American History has prepared a whole host of events and exhibits to commemorate this momentous occasion. We're posting a link that will show you a list of all the exhibits that will run from this coming April until January of 2019. Put them on your calendar and bring someone when you come. This week on the W. Wright blog, writer Tracy Crow links her own experience as a female Marine to the extraordinary yet forgotten history of Leland Librand, one of the first 10 women to join the Marines in 1918. Crow recounts the story how she discovered Leela for her upcoming book, It's My Country Too, Women's Military Stories from the American Revolution to Afghanistan. This sounds like a must-read during Women's History Month. In our Stories of Service section this week, we often talk about the all-African American Harlem Hellfighters Regiment as an example of diversity in the war. This week, we will meet other soldiers from other ethnic groups, such as Shinichi Takanuchi. Shinichi is the son of Japanese immigrants who answered the call to service in 1918. Learn more about him and about diversity in World War I and our veterans by going to the link that you see in the window right now. All right, moving on. Let's see what's going on in the world of social media in the buzz with Kathy Akey. Kathy, what's trending on our social media conversation wall this week?
Well, obviously, it's March, which means we're thinking a lot about women. But before we dive into that, there's a really exciting new initiative being pushed by the American Experience over at PBS. They're coming out with a Great War documentary pretty soon. And leading up to that, they've started this tag, War Letter Wednesday, which just started today. They'll be showcasing letters from people from all rank and file during World War I. And they started off this week with a little quote from a letter from Eugene Boulard, who was an African-American pilot with the French Foreign Legion, who joined up with the war way before the Americans even joined officially. It's well worth making sure you check out that tag, and you're welcome to share your war letters and your wartime correspondence stories as well by using that hashtag, #WarLetterWednesday. Now for the women, I love this picture we shared of the Women's Land Army of America. This was an American response to England's land lassies. And it was created entirely by the women themselves. This is not a government-run program. Women from colleges like Vassar, women from the YWCA, from suffrage societies, garden clubs, they came together and said, we need to help, and how can we help? And they decided, we can help by replacing the male workforce in the agricultural industry. And they did. They did a lot of jobs that men thought only they could do, and they did them in pants, which at the time was pretty shocking. And a last little nod to women, as it is International Women's Day, this wonderful poster I want you for the Navy, showing this beautiful illustration of a slightly androgynous woman. Now, women were not technically allowed in the Navy until the U.S. Naval Reserve Act of 1916, allowing yeomans, parentheses, F, to join the Navy. So women joined. There was several thousand, some 13,000 women admitted into active duty in the Navy and Marines during World War I. Although that took quite a while for those numbers to get up. It's just a beautiful poster showing how women sort of began joining into the Navy over the course of the war.
Thank you, Kathy. And I love the Wednesday hashtag. That's wonderful. And I look forward to seeing more about that. Great. That's our show for today. Thank you to our guests, Mike Schuster and Kathy Akey. And thank you for your interest in taking time to learn more about World War I 100 years ago and World War I commemoration today. I'm Teresa Sims. We look forward to talking to you next week.
World War I Centennial News is brought to you by the U.S. World War I Centennial Commission and the Commission's founding sponsor, the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. The video can be found at www.ccc.org/cn. Don't forget to sign up for our e-newsletter, The Weekly Dispatch. Our Twitter and Instagram handles are both at WW1CC, and we're on Facebook at WW1Centennial. The podcast of World War I Centennial News can be found in the iTunes store, so you can enjoy the show anytime. Just subscribe. Thank you for joining us, and don't forget to commemorate. So long.